Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning call and talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. I want to mention that also coming up later today on the Afternoon Magazine, when, how, and whether or not to regulate contemporary culture. Many people are concerned about sex and violence in the mass media and want industry standards or government regulations to shield young people. But many others see regulation of such content as nothing but censorship. Guest host Jim Meadows talks with two experts with differing points of view about this issue, and we'll also take your phone calls. It's coming up at 1 o'clock on the Afternoon Magazine today, right here on AM 580. During this hour of Focus 580, we will be taking your questions on women's health, something we do once a month on the show. With us, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She joins us every fourth Monday at 10 o'clock to take your questions. She's a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois, practicing physician, engaged in a number of research projects, and she keeps up on the field, and we'll talk about that. Take your questions during this first hour of the show. If you'd like to join us, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Use that number if you're outside of Champaign-Urbana, and we'll pay for the call. The numbers again, Champaign-Urbana-wise, 333-WILL. Otherwise, 800-222-WILL. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me back.
It's always fun having you on the show.
Thank you.
So, anything particular in the news that you want to start with?
Well, there are quite a few interesting items. There's something new in breast cancer research, and like what's mostly new in the media, it isn't something that you can rush right over to your physician and get this test, but it looks very exciting and promising. Just like there are some screening tests, as we know, there's not a particularly good one, but there is a screening test called CA125 for ovarian cancer. There's an excellent screening test for cervical cancer, being the pap smear. And for men, there's a pretty good screening test for prostate cancer and the PSA. And these are the kinds of things that we do all the time in medical care. We take fairly inexpensive, fairly accurate tests and apply them to pretty much anybody that walks in the front door and try to target a group of individuals that might, in fact, be suffering from something more serious. Well, and this is the direction we've gone in breast cancer research as well. And that's what, in fact, the mammogram is. And the mammogram's been pretty good, but it still has a known false positive rate. It still has a known false negative rate. And we always have to remind ourselves, even when a mammogram picks up a lump, it's probably been there as a cancerous growth for a number of years, because cancers do start out as one cell, and it takes literally 5 to 10 to 12 years to become something that is a palpable lump or even something that might show up on mammogram. So they've been working on this aspect, and they've come up with this new test on nipple fluid. And unfortunately, not very many women can express their breast and get fluids. Some women can, and that would be a benefit in a situation like this. But right now, unfortunately, the researchers have to collect the nipple fluid with a needle. And so I'm foreseeing that this is going to present problems of discomfort. But they're looking at something called basic fibroblast growth factor. And fibroblasts are precursor cells that eventually turn into muscle or fibrous tissue. So they would be, in fact, be cells that eventually would turn into the basic duct kinds of cells of the breast. And it turns out that in women who have breast cancer, they have elevated levels of this substance. So researchers are thinking they're going to be able to develop this into a screening test. So we don't know. Mm-hmm. It's probably several years away, but it's definitely going to be something that younger women can participate. We have a real problem using mammograms as a screening device for breast cancer in younger women, because younger women's breasts have so much fluid and so many thick, crowded together glands that the x-rays aren't particularly revealing. So that's why we don't really recommend them at very young ages, unless we have to use them for some, to check out a lump that we already feel and we know that it's there. So this is going to potentially be the most exciting development in breast cancer prevention in a long time.
Now, how early would that kind of screening pick up something?
Well, they are postulating that it would be earlier than when a mammogram or a palpable lump is picked up. So exactly how much earlier, but even if we get it in the 1 to 2 year stage earlier, the cure rates are going to skyrocket, because if we can pick up something that's a breast cancer that's just visible as a spot on a mammogram, cure rates are extraordinarily high. Whereas if a woman comes in and she has a lump that's clearly a breast cancer and she already has a lump under her arm, in other words, more advanced stages of breast cancer, the cure rates at 5 years are significantly lower.
Wow. Interesting. Well, we're again talking with Suzanne Troopin, and any questions are welcome on women's health issues. If you'd like to join us, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. There was a report in the news that I wanted to ask you about, having to do with the use of oral contraceptives. And a report came out looking at various nations around the world about the first-year pregnancy rate. And basically the report says that while oral contraceptives are widely available in many nations, they're not used very, very well. And that this results in a lot of pregnancies because women just don't use them right, or don't know how to use them, or maybe they know, and somehow it just doesn't happen.
Well, years ago we used to say that we used to report contraceptive research as a method of success or user success rate,
right.
Or they used to call it user failure rates or method failure rates. And now we have eliminated those terms, and we talk about typical use success rates and perfect use success rates. And I think this has helped even with the terminology to put the risk of contraceptive use in perspective. A couple of other things have gone on. Years ago, very potent birth control pills were available. When the pill was first developed, it probably had almost 100% more hormone in it than it has today. Those stronger pills were also available in other countries for lots longer. Some of them may still be available. I haven't kept up with it in the last few years. But those stronger pills definitely had lower failure rates. Not only that, but typical use didn't matter as much as it matters now with these low dose birth control pills. So in other words, if the pill was strong enough, you could skip a day or two, and the hormone level was still high enough in your body to prevent ovulation and prevent conception. And in fact, this is why we discovered that you could use such low dose of hormones and still have good contraceptive efficacy and still have the so-called non-contraceptive benefits of the pill, things like prevention of breast cysts, prevention of ovarian cysts, prevention of ovarian cancer, prevention of fibroids, control of heavy menstrual bleeding. You can still have these benefits at significantly lower levels of hormone in the pill. But you still do have the problem in failure rate if you don't take your pills consistently. And exactly how to get that information to individuals is a tougher a call. It's not so much the medicine itself, but it's the lifestyle of the woman. So what we in America have done is we've tried to tie it into other so-called health behaviors. So, for instance, one company always gave out a toothbrush with your birth control pill and said, when you brush your teeth at night, you know, use this toothbrush, and it's got your birth control pill name on it, and go grab your pills and swallow them at the same time. So just little lifestyle factors that help you remember, take a pill every day. They've done a lot of research in the American market to package pills a particular way or to label the individual pill days a certain way to help American women take the pills. But I don't think all that market research has gone into all kinds of different cultures. Say it's a poor country and you don't own a whole lot of furniture. Your family owns maybe one dresser. And, you know, you don't maybe even have a specialized spot to put your pills that no one else in the family would have access to, so they wouldn't get shoved aside or whatever. And these kinds of issues have become an important issue. I remember one kind of, I don't want to use the term funny but humorous kind of story where they were doing research in India, and this was literally years, 20, 30 years ago, in a very small community, not a high literacy rate community, and they were trying to help women figure out how to take their pills. And they came up with the concept of a necklace because a lot of the women wore a lot of very beautiful jewelry. So they had a necklace, and each day you took your pill, you were supposed to move a bead from one part of the necklace to another. And women in this, it failed dismally because the women thought that by moving the bead, they had accomplished part of the contraceptive value in the system. And they didn't adequately communicate to the women that it was just a device, a reminding device, and it had nothing to do with pill use itself. So I think usage is a big problem. And that's why in the United States, particularly young women have really cut on to the idea of injectable long-term contraceptives. So you only have to do one health behavior every 12 weeks and you are covered. And in fact, the teen pregnancy rate is the lowest. It's 20% lower in the year 2000 than it was in the year 1990 in the United States. So it's gone from about 80 some births per thousand young women down to about 45 births per thousand young women. Wow. In the past 10 years. And we attribute a lot of that to better contraceptive methods.
Very good. We have a call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. This is a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. My wife and I are expecting our firstborn about 6 weeks.
Great.
And wondered what Dr. Troopin's thoughts are on saving the cord blood at birth.
Well, that's an excellent question. There are a couple of companies that have done it. For those individuals that may not know, cord blood itself can be used for the cells, are very plastic cells, different than the kind of blood cells that adults have circulating in their system, and they can be used to so-called stem cells, or cells that literally can make almost any tissue in the body. And stem cell research has been very exciting. And we even think stem cell research may provide cures for Alzheimer's and so forth. And there are a couple of different schools of thought. First of all, number one, stem cell research has been a little bit slowed in the United States for various reasons, which cross over into the abortion controversy, because not just cord blood, but fetal tissues can provide stem cells. So there's been this mix of these two issues between saving cord blood and getting fetal cells that has stymied some of the research, because there is a congressional ban on some of this research that's hopefully going to be lifted. But so first of all, we haven't really even gotten enough research. Then there are these two schools of thought, one that says that that cord cell storage is available and might be useful in particular families, and it should be offered to individuals, and that they can make their own decision and pay for this blood to be stored. And then, as you probably, if you've looked into it at all, have discovered that you got to pay a fee down the line to keep it being stored, or it's going to be discarded if you don't pay your bills at some point. There's places, and I believe it was New York, it may be California also, I really haven't looked into it lately, where groups of individuals got together and said, you know, stem cell research can benefit a lot of individuals, and cord blood can benefit a lot of individuals, and it doesn't have to be so specifically matched. I mean, one reason to have your baby's own cord blood is that baby is always going to be very compatible with its own cord blood, and other family members will too. But it's plastic enough that whole populations of individuals could probably be served by a particular baby's cord blood. So there are some states that are trying on a statewide basis to bank cord blood, just like we bank other blood. And if you or I needed blood tomorrow in a car accident or something, we just go to the blood bank and get a stranger's blood. And this can be done with cord blood as well. So to make a long story short, it's available. There is a particular company, and I can't, you may know, I don't remember. I know that they have websites and so forth, and I think I have their literature in my office. So if you really don't know the name of the company, you could always contact me at some point. I'm sure I can find it. But So it is available. It's a reasonably good idea. Very few individuals are actually doing it. And I suspect within the next 5 to 10 years, most states will have some sort of banking policy that will enable them to collect cord blood.
But we don't know how long this, but if they freeze it, who knows, it may not last for 50 years when you really need it. We don't know that yet.
Well, see, that would be the point of having more universal access, because then you're right. The baby's mostly not going to need it till you're significantly older, although there's, you know, some cases of diabetes may be able to be solved by these stem cells and so forth. And, you know, young children do get diabetes. But the problem is that some of these things aren't developed yet. So, you know, your child may be, say, 8 years old, develop diabetes, but the stem cell research hasn't figured out how to cure diabetes with this until your child's now, say, 25. So there's so much going on. It's really in its infancy in terms of the research.
The infancy in more ways than one.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I've been told it's a very low possibility of even needing it anyway. I mean,
and that's why a lot of people, you know, it's one of those things in medicine where it is available, and I think very few obstetricians are really discussing it with their obstetrical patients. I went through a great flurry of excitement at one point, and we were sent a lot of videotapes from the company to hand to all our pregnant patients and say, watch this, this is available, this is the pros and cons, and, you know, make your own decision. And then it just seemed like the likelihood of anybody needing it was low, and none of my patients availed themselves of the opportunity and actually bought the storage that I know of. I remember collecting it. And I lost my initial flurry of enthusiasm and thought that maybe I'd look into it again in a few more years when things get a little bit farther down along the established medical pathways.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to mull this over. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for the call, and good luck.
Yeah.
Congratulations. You mentioned the idea that a treatment might be developed from stem cell research. You used the example of diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason for that kind of optimism? Is there?
Oh, yes. Yeah. There. Of course, I'm not a diabetic specialist, so, you know, hit up one of the internists when they sit down on your show, or an endocrinologist mm-hmm. who's maybe followed this research more specifically. But I think they've made a lot of progress in the laboratory getting cells to develop into pancreatic type cells and get those cells to release insulin in response to sugar challenge. But exactly how far along that is to getting those cells to take up residence inside someone else and get them to perform like they're supposed to perform is still somewhat of an unknown. But I would predict within 5 to 10 years we will have that. And that's definitely where the research is going. A lot of the exciting research is being done in countries other than the United States. And for those interested, should definitely look into the foreign research on it, because their rules and regulations are just a lot less strict. And if you really look into much medical research, it does start abroad. And we can discuss the ethics of that. But I think that the research done in foreign countries is still quite excellent, but it's so cost prohibitive to start from scratch in the United States that you will discover that most companies start elsewhere looking into their products.
Wow. Well, I think speaking of stem cell research, there was a story the other day, I believe that federal guidelines, there was an administrative order or something along those lines, making it possible for federal funding for the first time. Because there was this ban on it because of ethical issues. And I think that they finally got the federal guidelines, and even those concerned that it would be leading to more abortions for the sake of, you know, generating tissue, that there were people who had opposed it previously who signed on and said these guidelines are acceptable.
And I think what they did was absolutely right. They needed to sit back, convene a panel, figure out what the issues were, figure out where they stand on the issues, and figure out a rational government policy. And I think that that was perfect. And you're right, we're just now entering where they're going to be able to get some money for this research, and I think the research will explode. There'll be so much.
We have another call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. I'll mention the phone numbers again. We're almost at our midpoint with Dr. Suzanne Troopin, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois, practicing physician, taking your questions about women's health issues. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. This is a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. Last week, I saw an article in the newspaper about a medication called Lotrinex, or however it's pronounced, for IBS and the awful side effects that it was having. And I'm wondering, I had just been prescribed something called chlordiazepoxide and clidinium. Is that the same derivation? Should I stop taking this stuff?
I think, I'm not sure you're pronouncing your medication right, but
either.
I think that the medication that you're on has been around for a long time, and
okay.
The side effects that you read on your materials from your pharmacist are pretty true to form and modest, and if you're already on the medication and not experiencing the side effects, it's an excellent sign. But if you have any direct questions about the medicine you're on or the dosage, you could call your physician, your own physician or your pharmacist directly. I didn't see the article about the newer medication for IBS. I know that we met that medication with a lot of excitement that it would help individuals who up to now had only had very modest effects with the other more commonly used medications. So I'll have to look into that. I can say as a general remark that it's a little bit tough. What we were talking about, I don't know if you were listening earlier, with contraceptive effectiveness, same too with side effects. When we do research studies, we search for the ideal candidate. I was just mentioning before we got onto this program, one of my research studies, we're really having a tough time finding the ideal candidate because the restrictions are so great. So number one, we get these ideal candidates. And number two, if they have side effects, individuals often will drop out of the research study because of the side effects they're having. So the side effect profiles are not as well worked out because of these very stringent requirements by the time the medication gets released for general use. And it's not until the medication gets released for general use that we find out what the true incidence of side effects is going to be in the population. And in some cases, it may be less, not more. It is possible, but usually as less perfect candidates are placed by their own physicians on the medicine, the side effect profiles go up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the call. We'll go next to a listener in Urbana on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I've been hearing that apparently the Food and Drug Administration is considering the possibility of making birth control pills non-prescription items. And I've seen various comments from people about the advisability of this. Some people say, yes, it would make birth control pills much more private and more readily accessible to people. And others think that this is the way the drug companies are trying to avoid having to cover birth control pills under prescription drug coverage, although they cover Viagra. And that it also would mean that women would be less likely to get in to see a doctor and problems that they haven't gotten around to getting checked out, they get seen and are cared for. So if they have an infection or a breast lump, it's more likely to turn up because of regular visits or annual visits to a doctor to get their birth control pills re-upped. And I was wondering what you thought about it.
Well, it's an excellent question. And here I'll give you the quick answer. I think they should go OTC. But I do agree that, which means over the counter. Doctors always speak in lingo. It's genetic, I guess. But I do share all the valid concerns that you're talking about as the issues. And in fact, I was giving a general lecture to an undergraduate class last spring, and the class had some papers that they were had written that they were presenting as part of this one session that I was taking part in, and this came up. And interestingly, this college class in general here at the University of Illinois, they thought they should not be available just walking into a pharmacy. They thought you should have to buy them. But I have a few comments, and I didn't get a chance to keep track of the different comments that you made, but just to kind of counterbalance some of the comments you made. One, in terms of funding, I definitely think it's an issue. Funding is a huge problem in the United States for contraceptives. There are a lot of plans, of which here in Champaign-Urbana, we have many consumers that are under these plans that are a religious organization, primarily Catholic-based, that because of the religious organization do not cover the funding. But still, many, many, many plans will cover prenatal care that will never cover contraceptive benefits. So just going OTC may not make that much of a difference in terms of funding. Now, there are a couple of states, and I think California is one. I think one weird one is like Virginia. A couple of states have passed rules that if you cover basic prescription items, you must provide for contraceptive pill coverage. And so this may be a changing thing. Number two, I think that that over-the-counter pill use has been used very successfully in many other countries, so we can look to that as our model. Number three, I think that birth control pill use has many more potential benefits and not so many statistically more side effects than other things that are already over-the-counter medications. And so I think that if we've proven ourselves as worthy consumers in these other areas, we can prove ourselves to be worthy consumers. I think the biggest block personally is that physicians don't want to really. It's a great moneymaker for some individual physicians to see their patients for an entire physical year after year in order to prescribe these pills. So I don't know. I think that the financial considerations are as much on the physician, provider, medical organization side as they are on the consumer side. So I think there are a lot of issues, but I think that these issues could be addressed. And I think that we'd have more individuals getting a lot of health benefits from long-term oral contraceptive use. We'd have less endometriosis, less uterine fibroids, less anemia, less premenstrual syndrome, less ovarian cancer. It has been estimated if all American women took birth control pills, we would eliminate 80% of the cases of ovarian cancer in the United States. And when a woman presents with ovarian cancer, she does not have a good outlook because 3/4 of those cases are advanced cases that have very low 5-year survival rates compared to, say, preventing that disease altogether. So I'm in favor of over-the-counter, but truthfully, I don't think we will see it in the United States for at least 10 years because of all these issues that I'm discussing, many of which are separate from the issues you brought up.
Yeah, thank you for the perspective. I also wanted to add a personal perspective about what something you said earlier about lifestyle being important in birth control use. I can remember being extremely responsible about taking birth control pills before I had any children and then going back on them after I'd finished breastfeeding my infant, my first infant, and my life was totally turned upside down by having a child. I mean, my schedule was all thrown off, and I was tired, and so what had worked before for taking birth control pills was not working for me when I was a young mother. And I hear so many people being really judgmental about people who manage to forget to take birth control pills, and I just wanted to say that it really is important, and it's not something that an individual user, it's obvious necessarily always to an individual user, and it took some effort on my part to find a time that would work better for me, and I can see how it would vary depending on the individual. We shouldn't be judgmental about women who aren't able to, who get pregnant accidentally while trying to figure this out. Thanks.
It's an excellent comment. I like to do the math for individuals. If they multiply 365 which is the number of days in the year, by 5, you will realize how many pills you have to take to in a 5-year span of time, you have to take more than 1,500 pills during that period of time. And that's a lot of individual acts of health behavior to do consistently. And with the lower dose pills, a slip up or two is all it takes to have a pill failure. So she's absolutely right.
Excellent point. We have one other caller waiting. We'll go right to them. I'll mention the phone numbers. We have just about maybe 18 minutes left in this hour with Suzanne Troopin, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois. We're talking about women's health issues. Any questions you have are welcome. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 to join our conversation. We'll go next to a listener in Villa Grove on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning, Dr. Troopin. I have a question for you. My son's wife is 33 and pregnant with the second child. And in order to conceive both children, she went through intensive fertility treatment. She has a long history of ovarian cancer in her family and has been advised to have a total hysterectomy as soon as they've achieved their desired number of children. My question is, after a total hysterectomy, what happens to her libido?
Well, there's no easy answer because libido is not just hormonally controlled. It's partially emotionally controlled, and we think that there's quite a bit of brain chemistry that is involved in libido as well. But as you must know from your conversations, that if a woman loses her ovary, she loses a significant amount of male hormone production in her system, so that virtually 100% of the actual testosterone that a woman has in her body comes from the ovaries themselves. Mm-hmm. However, only half of the adrenal androgens come from the ovaries themselves. So a woman is not left with no male hormones in her system after one of these hysterectomies. She's left with what's left in her adrenal gland. Most women, however, who are very young when they have this procedure, which I presume you didn't say her age, but let's presume she's going to be at least a decade or more away from her natural age of menopause, will benefit not only from estrogen replacement therapy, but androgen replacement therapy. And there are estrogen-testosterone combinations that are designed to mimic the hormonal levels of the woman's own ovary. And it is something that most likely her gynecologist will talk to her about in terms of the risks and the benefits and the products available.
Okay, she is 33, mm-hmm. So she is quite young to be considering that. But it seems like as though there aren't too many other alternatives.
Well, there are some testosterone can be given as an injection, but it wears out fairly quickly. You'd have to take monthly injections. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is there are implantable pellets that you can implant, and you only need to replace them about every 6 months.
Oh.
But that seems to be something that gynecologists in the southern states use, and I've never even heard of another gynecologist in Illinois that uses them. I've used them a few times, but it's just not something that we use very commonly. Now, if you're talking about the choice in terms of prevention of cancer, she also has to remember that removing her uterus, her fallopian tubes, and her ovaries will decrease her risk of ovarian cancer, but she will not eliminate her risk of ovarian cancer. She still will have a 2-3% chance of contracting the disease.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. You've been very helpful.
Thanks for the call. We had a listener who off the air, I guess the person didn't want to go on the air, and that's okay. They wanted a discussion on Norplant, and I'm not quite sure what angle they wanted to take on that. I did see something in the news recently that was it Norplant that had some...
There was something in the news, and it talked about there was a stretch of kit manufacturers that they thought that the hormone level in the kit was a little bit low. And they advised individuals that received kits from these certain lot numbers to speak to their own physician. And the letter that I received from the company, I thought was a little confusing, frankly. And the statements from my own organization, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, basically said, well, yes, the hormone levels were a little bit low. The failure rates were a little bit high. They talked about normally counting on Noraplant to only have 2 or 3 failures per 1,000. And this could be as high as 3 or so failures per 100. So it was higher, but if you talked about, you know, still 97% efficacy, mm-hmm. which compared to, say, birth control pill inconsistent use is still high. You would expect a higher failure rate with inconsistent birth control pill use. So one organization was talking about finding out who received Noraplant from these certain lots and then possibly discussing with them the use of backup. So it was all very vague. And the way we do it in our office, and the way most people's insurance is, most of my patients went to a pharmacy, got their kit there, and then then bring them in and I insert mm-hmm. the device. And the pharmacist had already not gotten any of these kits with these lots. So it didn't pertain as much to my own individual patients. But if somebody out there has an Noraplant, they can just call their provider. They can find out what the lot number of the Noraplant was.
That information is kept?
Yes.
Yes.
And they can then, or should be kept if, you know, the record keeping was ideal. But most of us do write that down. And then they can check that against the company. It's Wyeth Ayres that has the company. You can go onto their website. You can check it. I noticed WebMD had, I think it's WBMD.com. Mm-hmm. I noticed they had something, but most of the major health sites that I log on to and check had something where you could log on, get those specific numbers, compare your number to that number, and figure out if you have a device that should require extra backup.
Okay. The caller might have been asking about Noraplant as a long-term strategy for birth control.
Oh, okay.
And what do you, I'm not sure what
okay.
exactly you want
well,
to say about that.
Well, as you may know, Noraplant is 6 rods that all have just a progesterone hormone called levonorgestrel in it. It's one of the widely available progesterone hormones that we have a lot of success with. And when these rods are inserted, they leak a small amount of hormone into the bloodstream. And that amount of hormone does 2 things. One, it's pretty good suppression against ovulation, but it primarily works by changing the cervical mucus so that it becomes an impenetrable barrier to sperm swimming through. And that's really why it works so rapidly. So within 24 hours of insertion, you have contraceptive protection. And also, once you get it removed, within 24 hours, the hormone levels go down so low that women can readily conceive that first cycle when they go off Noraplant. And it's an excellent long-term method. It's very, very easy to insert. However, that a fibrous capsule forms on the devices after they're inserted, and the removal is a little more tricky. So that what happened after it was released in the United States, it's one of these situations where the research studies were done by very experienced surgeons taking out and putting in these devices. And then it was released, and literally nurses, particularly, say, for instance, in places like Planned Parenthood, were practicing nurses who understood the basic techniques for removal but certainly weren't practicing surgeons, had a lot of trouble removing them. Same with some family practitioners, same with maybe even some gynecologists that didn't do a lot of surgery, so that the removal was much more difficult than the insertion. And this got a tremendous amount of press in the first few years after the device was released, and completely stopped the device dead in its tracks in the United States, so that actually very few American women use the Norplant or want to use the Norplant because of the negative publicity regarding the removal, and there was a lot of talk of lawsuits. I think there was even a class action suit. Truthfully, I don't even know what happened to that class action suit. I think it must have been settled in some fashion. But I think some of it was potentially avoidable, but it wasn't avoided. So I think that it's an excellent method, but you need to really know what you want because you're going to pay for that device up front. So over the 5 years, it's very cost effective. But if you pay for this Norplant device and then 6, 8, 12 months down the line decide you want to get pregnant, let's just take it out, then it's not very cost effective at all because you've now paid the cost of 5 years of contraception in 1 year.
Well, hope that gets to the caller's question. It's, I understand sometimes people want to leave a question instead of actually stating it on the air. But, our director, Brian, does the best job he can translating. But anyway, we'll hopefully that got the information that the listener wanted. We have a listener waiting on line number 4. Let's talk with them. This is someone in Georgetown. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning, Dr. Troopin. I had a hysterectomy 15 years ago, and I read in Ann Landers, and you sort of, if I understood you right, said this same thing to a previous caller when she was talking about a young woman having a total hysterectomy, that it does not totally prevent you from getting ovarian cancer. And if that is true, what are the symptoms you need to look for? From what I've read, it's a bloating, it's a cramping type thing, and I do have some diverticulitis, which I do have some of those symptoms. So how do you check that you don't have this ovarian cancer that you can get? I don't quite understand how you can still get it when your ovaries have been removed. So if you can
address that. Well, our ovaries are formed in fetal life closer to our kidney, and then the eggs migrate down a path to the ovaries itself. So there are these microscopic little rest cell areas that are actually ovarian tissue that when you look in at the time of surgery and you remove the specific organ, you have no way of knowing if any of these other little areas of tissue actually exist. And this is why some women do develop ovarian cancer. We don't have a lot of advice to give you. The signs and symptoms are subtle, and more than what you described is really not out there. They talk about abdominal fullness, weight loss, maybe some nausea. But these symptoms can be of many different diseases.
Right.
In a case like the other caller where the family had a very high risk situation, those families now may be separated out. And in those families, blood tests like CA125 or ultrasounds may in fact be cost effective, whereas in most of the population, getting those tests adds to medical costs, it adds to medical surgeries that are necessary, and it's not really been shown in research to be warranted to spring on the whole population. So really the best advice is still to have your yearly checkup. And at your yearly checkup, even if you've had a hysterectomy, your physician will be doing a pelvic examination and examining you for signs and symptoms of ovarian cancer. We may not always find it on that exam either, but that's the recommendation.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We have about 5 minutes left with Dr. Suzanne Troopin talking about women's health issues, and one caller waiting. We might be able to squeeze another in if you want to call us quickly. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Next up, a listener in Southern Illinois on line number 1. Good morning.
How are you doing? I have a question. Me and my wife were trying to have another baby. We have 2 already, and they're 2 years apart, and the last one's 3 years old, so hasn't been that long ago, but when we started, seemed like, her timing on her period hadn't changed in the amount of days, but there's been a little more excessive bleeding, but we haven't really been majorly concerned about that. But my main question, I wanted to ask you that, but my main question was, what, I know they say something about checking your temperature and stuff to have the baby, to conceive, Can you give me a pointer on that, please?
The best thing to do is go to any grocery store or pharmacy, and they have ovulation detection kits. They're much more accurate than taking your temperature, although most of the ovulation detection kits will discuss temperature taking as well. And most of these stores also sell what they call basal body thermometers, and the basal body thermometers are designed a little bit differently. They're more spread out to the normal temperature range, and they will have excellent explanation. But these ovulation detection kits, something that a woman can test her urine basically each morning around the time that she thinks she's going to be fertile, and the stick will turn blue on the day you should have sex. And that's sort of the short form, but they give you more lengthy explanations in how to, when to test and how to interpret the test and when to have sex and so forth. And so for individuals trying to get pregnant, particularly if it's been a few months, I usually advise that. Now, in a separate story about the heavier bleeding, now that's something that maybe she wants to get checked before she gets pregnant. She may, in fact, have uterine fibroids, which are extraordinarily common. About 1 in 4 women between the ages of 30 and 50 will have uterine fibroids. In some cases, they can be in locations that can affect a pregnancy, although many women can go through pregnancy with fibroids and not have it be significant. But it's worth getting heavier bleeding checked out prior to conception rather than waiting till after you conceive and discovering that there was something going on that maybe should have been checked out. With uterine fibroids, there are medical treatments and there are surgical treatments. For individuals who want to conceive, we tend to use either just removing, if we're going to do surgery, just removing the fibroid itself, and that can be done through an operation called a myomectomy or an operation called a hysteroscopy resection, or we use medicines that shrink down the fibroid. One of the problems with the medicines that they have released in the United States is that they do a good job of shrinking down the fibroids while you're on the medicine, but the medicine's so potent and has so many side effects, you can only stay on it a few months. When you go off the medicine, the fibroids come right back. So all our research has been at developing similar kinds of medicines that aren't so strong, don't have so many side effects, and ways of administering the medicine that not only shrink down the fibroids but allow you to stay on the medicine for longer periods of time. And that's one of the research studies that I'm participating in. Might not directly affect a woman such as your wife who wants to get pregnant faster, probably wants to move faster through the system. But if individuals want to try to avoid fibroids, we're hoping that some of this, avoid surgery for fibroids, we're hoping some of this research will help them achieve that.
Okay, what was those two tests? And I'm going to hang up. And what in the world is a fibroid?
it's a muscle knot that it occurs in the uterus, and it's a it's sort of a growth. So it's made of the identical muscle that the uterus itself is made, but it forms in a knot and can occur anywhere in the uterus. Very common. The two tests, one is ovulation detection kit, and I know one brand, I hate to publicize brands, but one brand has such a cute name. It's called OvuStick, but ovulation detection kit, and the other is a basal body temperature thermometer. And really, I think if you just went to your local pharmacy and said to the pharmacist, we're trying to get pregnant, what tests can I maybe buy to help me? And they'll direct you to these.
Well, very good. We're about at the point where we're going to have to stop, and I can just wanted to actually write this down myself because I know you have a website and also pass it on to other folks because, you know, I think you have a lot of good information there.
Well, thank you. Our website is, of course, www, and I call my practice Women's Health Practice, so it's Women's Health Practice, all run together, .com, and we try to include a lot of health information on there. I try to put stories if I've done some stories in magazines, things like that. I try to transcribe those onto there. And I try to take some of these issues that come up in the media and talk about what I think women should do based on what the story is saying. And try to put a few other interesting things on there as well. I try to keep it up. A good friend of mine is my webmaster. My site isn't as glitzy as some, but I try to put a lot of information on it.
That's all right. Glitz isn't necessary. Usefulness is desired. So
thanks.
Good. Womenshealthpractice.com. Dr. Suzanne Troopin has been our guest, and she'll join us again next month on the fourth Monday. And thanks for being here.
Thank you.